Chapter 8. Enter the KGB. Berlin in the mid-1980s was a divided city on the front line of the Cold War. A wall cut off the communist east from the west, with border guards ready to shoot and kill those trying to escape while spies plied their trade. It was here that a young West German man handed Cliff Stoll's report on the Morris worm to an older man. The young man, a sometime croupier at casinos, fronted for a loose group of oddball hackers. He thought the older man would be interested in Stoll's damage assessment. He knew it might provide useful ideas about replicating the kind of attack on computers that the Internet had just witnessed. The older man who received the report was known to him as Sergei and worked for the KGB. The two were engaged in the first proven case of state espionage over computer networks. What they did not know was that Stoll was on their trail. Cliff Stoll was not the kind of person you would expect to lead an international cyber counter-espionage operation. He was a wild-haired, slightly manic, left-wing Californian astronomer who had turned to being a computer systems administrator when his academic funding ran out. The role of systems administrator is like being the caretaker of an apartment building, making sure everything is working right, that no one is causing any problems, and everyone is playing by the house rules, keeping the place clean and dealing with any problems or faults by repairing or patching them up. Stoll was like a caretaker who stumbled on a Cold War spy ring operating out of his building, but in electronic form. The paltry sum of 75 cents set Cliff Stoll off on the spy trail. A record was kept of who had used the system and for how long, so they could be properly billed for their time. Someone in 1986 had been using his system and not paying. Stoll wanted to find out who they were. A few days later, Stoll had got a message from a user of an obscure computer named Dockmaster, based in Maryland, saying that someone had tried to break into their system over the weekend, and it looked like it was coming from Cliff Stoll's lab. What is Dockmaster? Stoll had wondered at the time. Probably some bank, he and his colleagues had decided. Stoll started to dig deeper. Who was the mysterious user behind the strange logins who used the name Hunter? Was it a student? The first trails ended up being dead ends or false leads. Whoever was playing around with the systems was managing to cover their tracks, using the anonymity of computer systems to route their phone connections through different locations in the US to hide where they really were. This created what is known today as the attribution problem. When everything is ones and zeros, it is easy to route them through different network points and mask who you really are and where you are coming from. Stoll became a man on a mission. He slumbered in a sleeping bag by his computer and waited until an alarm told him there was a suspicious connection. He realized that if he was going to catch the perpetrator, it was better to watch him and learn rather than shut him off. This was the beginning of counter-espionage work on the web. It is the same type of counter-espionage activity that spy catchers in places like MI5 and the FBI carried out in the Cold War. Put your suspect under surveillance, follow him, learn about him, build a case, wait for a misstep. Stoll realized the attacker was smart. He had adopted privileges on the computer which allowed him to change the way programs operated. But he was not destroying things. He was exploring. And he was also careful. When he had hacked in, he would periodically issue a command to tell him who else was logged in. He was adopting what spies would call counter-surveillance measures, the equivalent of stopping and tying your shoelaces to look back over your shoulder and see if anyone was following you. Stoll realized he had to hide himself. This was electronic hide-and-seek. When he approached them, the local FBI seemed uninterested. You want us to investigate someone who has stolen 75 cents worth of computing time? They asked incredulously. Stoll watched as the hacker jumped from his system over to Milnet, the military part of the Internet, which had been hived off from the civilian part in 1983. He was heading for Air Force Systems, contractors working on satellites and part of the U.S. Army missile complex that was online, using a Trojan horse program to fool people into giving away their passwords. At the U.S. Air Force, Stoll's call found its way to Jim Christie, who worked as an investigator at the Air Force Office of Special Investigations at Bolling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. Even though in 1978 the Air Force had set up what was thought to have been the first law enforcement team dedicated to computer crime, Christie found higher-ups uninterested in Stoll's case. "I had to meet with the CI, counterintelligence guys, who spelt computer with a K. I spent 4 hours trying to convince them that it was a national security issue." Since the counterintelligence people were dismissive, Christie began running the case as a time and attendance fraud case. Slowly, a small community grew up who shared an interest in solving the mystery. The hacker seemed to be searching in particular for information about NORAD and one particular program, Star Wars, or to give it its proper name, the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, was a signature program of Ronald Reagan's presidency. In the 1980s, the danger of nuclear oblivion still loomed. Star Wars aimed to alter the balance of the Cold War by shooting down Soviet missiles with lasers in space. This would protect America, but also undermine the concept of mutually assured nuclear destruction. This was part of a new strategy to push the Soviet Union harder, arming rebels in Afghanistan and upping the rhetoric about an evil empire. The project embodied Reagan's optimistic faith in technology. As science, it was hokum and never came close to working. But as part of a broader campaign of putting psychological pressure on the enemy, it worked a treat. It made the Soviets paranoid that they were falling behind in technology, which they were, and undermined their morale. The Soviets were desperate to find out what they could about Star Wars and, if possible, steal the technology. The CIA had already taken advantage of the Soviet hunger for technology earlier in the decade in one of the most noteworthy but underappreciated intelligence operations of the late Cold War. President Mitterrand of France took President Reagan aside for a discreet conversation on the sidelines of a meeting of world leaders in July 1981. Mitterrand surprised Reagan by revealing that France had managed something that America's CIA had struggled to achieve, a deep-level penetration of the KGB. The mole, Colonel Vladimir Vetrov, was providing thousands of documents, snapped with a Minox camera or photocopied. The information outlined how Line X of the KGB was tasked with stealing the most advanced Western technology. The Soviets estimated that stealing documents on the U.S. F-18 fighter jet saved 5 years of development and tens of millions of dollars, as they could copy elements like the fire control radar for their own latest generation fighters. The target list also included high-end computers, which communist countries were banned from importing. Computers, like fighter jets, were becoming a key component of national security and therefore a target for espionage. The Soviet Union had fallen well behind in the computer race by the 1980s, 15 years by some estimates. At the start of the Cold War, it had been close to the pace, starting to build its own stored program computer in 1948. And the country was as good, if not better, than the West at cryptanalysis, with a rich tradition of codes and brilliant mathematicians. Some of the work was based at Marfina Sharashka, a secret research and development laboratory in the Soviet Gulag labor camps, described by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in The First Circle. Everything stemmed from there, and the methods were barbaric, of course, but ultimately a pretty serious cryptography tradition was created whose fruits we are enjoying to this day, a senior Russian electronics expert commented recently. The USSR invested in cryptanalytics special-purpose machines, but struggled with general-purpose digital computers. In the 1970s, their latest Riyadh system was a reverse-engineered and poorer-functioning version of an IBM computer. A centrally planned economy stifled the kind of innovation and risk-taking needed in high technology. From the late 1960s, the USSR had become increasingly worried about lagging behind in something clearly important to both economic growth and military might, as well as a symbol of superpower status. That led the KGB to focus on stealing Western computer technology to catch up. It had a long-standing agent, a French citizen who had been born in Russia, codenamed Alvar, in a senior position inside IBM's European headquarters in Paris from the 1950s through to his retirement in the late 1970s, who received the Order of the Red Banner for his efforts. Alvar seems to have passed on details of computer networking and its security, which were then copied by the Soviet Defense Ministry. Other agents were also in place in companies. In communist East Germany, the spy service extended considerable energy in trying to place spies inside the West German wing of IBM. This meant that the top East German electronics company soon became so heavily dependent on surreptitiously acquiring IBM's technological advances that it was in effect a sort of illegal subsidiary of that company, wrote East Germany's top spymaster, Markus Wolf. This form of spying, transferring technology, was crucial to any power worried that its opponent was ahead. Vertov's role was to sit at the meeting point between the demands of Soviet state industry and the work of the KGB in fulfilling its need for a wide array of Western high-tech equipment. The Russian had crashed his car in Paris and made a panicked call to a man who was a source for the French Domestic Security Service, the DST. That led to Vertov being recruited as a spy. He was a classic disaffected agent, egotistical, unstable, unhappy with his career and colleagues, who drank too much and had a messy personal life. But he had top-level access. The French DST, unused to running agents abroad, turned not to their own overseas intelligence agency, but to Britain's MI6 for advice on how to run Vertov in Moscow, since they had more experience with agents. Vertov had been given the codename Farewell and revealed a goldmine, including the full requirements list for Soviet technical intelligence, which ran to hundreds of pages and listed every piece of technology the Soviets were seeking from the West and where they hoped to get them from. Vertov also provided the names of the undercover Soviet agents tasked with undertaking this massive acquisition. British intelligence advised the French that to fully exploit this, the Americans should be brought in, leading to Mitterrand's disclosure to Reagan. In Washington, an advisor to the president on technology, called Guy Weiss, saw a possibility. Immediately recognizable for his lack of hair and known by some as Dr. Strange Weiss, in tribute to the scientist in the iconic Cold War film Dr. Strange Love, Weiss came up with a plan to exploit this intelligence treasure trove to support Reagan's strategy of putting pressure on the Soviets. This could be done by making use of the Linex shopping list. I met with Director of Central Intelligence William Casey on an afternoon in January 1982. I proposed using the Farewell material to feed or play back the products sought by Linex, but these would come from our own sources and would have been improved, that is, designed so that on arrival in the Soviet Union, they would appear genuine but would later fail, Weiss later wrote in a document now declassified by the CIA. The theory was that even if the Soviets began to see what was happening, they would no longer be able to trust any of the technology they acquired, rendering their whole effort useless. The Pentagon introduced misleading information on stealth aircraft, space defense, and tactical aircraft. The Soviets ended up using a design for a space shuttle rejected by NASA. Computers were part of this operation. Contrived computer chips found their way into Soviet military equipment, flawed turbines were installed on a gas pipeline, and defective plans disrupted the output of chemical plants and a tractor factory, Weiss claimed. There have been widely repeated allegations that a massive explosion on a Siberian pipeline was the result of a virus introduced into the exported software controlling valves and turbines, a so-called logic bomb. U.S. officials with knowledge of the classified record offer no confirmation, although it may be that it remains classified. And so this use of computer code to carry out physical sabotage, often cited as the first case, remains unproven. Russian experts also say they are doubtful of this story. Vetrov himself ended up stabbing a man in a park as part of a bizarre incident in which he may have been trying to kill his mistress. The result was that his treachery was uncovered, and he met the traditional Soviet fate of execution. But he had a significant impact in helping the West understand Soviet technological insecurity and in increasing that insecurity by raising suspicions about whether stolen technology could be trusted by sabotaging the hardware. In his nightly vigils by his computer screen, Cliff Stoll had stumbled on the Soviet Union learning how to spy over computer networks in the later part of the 1980s as it sought to use a new means, what we now call cyber espionage, to steal technology and catch up. The USSR was spying through computer networks, but it could not yet be spied on. The whole Soviet bloc simply did not have the widespread use of computers among companies, contractors, and laboratories that the US enjoyed. And what computers it did have were not yet linked up to the early Internet, which was still US-dominated. Russia continues to have its own classified network not connected to the Internet. This means the Soviet systems were not accessible in the way American systems were. And the places that were using computers and were networked up were precisely the places that engaged in the high-tech research that the Soviets were most hungry for. In 1979, Roger Schell had predicted a KGB man explaining to colleagues what riches lay on American networks. Now, a few years later, he was being proved right. What was crucial about this new world of hacking compared to the old world of intercepting communications was that it offered access to the mass of data stored on computers in their databases, known as data at rest, rather than just the narrower field of data in motion, which was being sent from one place to another by someone. If you could get inside these systems, you could get access to the trove of information kept in databases and then extract it. This was at the heart of the operation Cliff Stoll had stumbled across. Stoll watched as the hacker began looking for pathways into the CIA and into DocMaster, which Stoll now realized was linked to the NSA. Those agencies began to get interested in Stoll's work. The CIA began following the case daily. They and the NSA encouraged Stoll to keep at it, although, thanks to the country's bureaucratic turf wars, neither wanted to tell him or the other agency what they knew, so Stoll was left to his own devices. The hacker was also patient and persistent. He wasn't picking locks so much as wandering about, seeing who had left their windows open through poor security, and then using that as a chance to get in and rummage around. Stoll began to get to know his adversary and his personality through his online behavior, just as the people intercepting radio messages in the Second World War could often tell who was tapping out a Morse code signal from the way they hit the keys, known as fingerprinting. This hacker was confident and arrogant, Stoll thought. He also noticed he operated at unusual times, normally early afternoon. Most hackers worked late at night. What if he was in Europe? Stoll gave a talk to the National Computer Security Center about what he was learning. He kept being interrupted by a bearded guy who asked him about astronomy. Afterwards, the man introduced himself as Bob Morris and took him to meet the assistant director of the NSA. Stoll wondered what he, as a long-haired astronomer without either a tie or a security clearance, was doing briefing the NSA, but nevertheless explained what he had found. The assistant director explained that the NSA was having difficulty convincing senior officials that computer security really was a problem and wanted Stoll to brief some of them. "Can't you just tell them?" Stoll asked. "We've been telling them for years," Morris said, "but this is the first documented case." Cliff Stoll's day-to-day logbook, the NSA man explained, was the first hard evidence that America's enemies were spying on it over computer networks. Stoll was becoming less and less sure that the people he was talking to were the warmongering puppets of Wall Street that he had expected, leading some of his Berkeley friends to think he had gone a bit native with the spooks. Stoll's motivation was anger at someone getting inside his network and then using it to jump off and do the same to others, even if they did belong to the military and do strange things with satellites and missiles. For him, this was a community being attacked, not a computer being penetrated. There was a feeling of vulnerability and violation that came from someone else being on your system. Stoll's girlfriend came up with a clever idea. Why not create a file of what looked like Star Wars material to lure the hacker out into a place where he might spend long enough for his phone to be traced? This was the electronic equivalent of the good old spy trick of a honey trap. Put something too good to be resisted, whether a secret file or a pretty woman or man, and wait for your target to do the rest. People were behind cyber attacks, and they were only human after all. The hacker fell for the trap. When he came across the files full of jargon which seemed to be about the program, he spent an hour looking at them. That was enough time to trace him to Hanover. In Germany, a rich subculture of hacking was developing. It overlapped with a youth culture that resented authority and the older generation. It rejected the politics of the Cold War and those of corporations it saw as serving the state. This was not the violent anti-authoritarianism of the Red Army faction, which carried out physical attacks, but it was a subculture which encouraged resistance and found common purpose in the American libertarian cyberpunk generation. The German Chaos Computer Club, a mildly anarchic collective founded in 1984, was at the leading edge, with many experimenting with viruses. Politics and hacking fused in Germany in a way that never quite occurred in Britain. It was fueled by fiction, including the book New Romancer by William Gibson, published in 1984. In it, all computers linked into a global network, which created an artificial, three-dimensional place through which you could navigate. Gibson coined the term cyberspace to describe it. A well-thumbed copy of New Romancer was in Robert T. Morris's room. Also inspired by New Romancer was the group of hackers from Hanover that Stoll had stumbled upon. The member of the group whom Stoll had been watching was called Marcus Hess. Hess enjoyed reading spy thrillers, and from his quiet suburban background he seemed to enjoy being part of his own spy story. He had been inspired by seeing the film War Games on German TV and wanted to imitate the character in it by getting into NORAD. Hacking offered empowerment, a chance to reach out from your bedroom and get inside the most powerful organizations in the world. But Hess's skills had come to be recognized by others. One of them was a wacky, drugged-up individual who went by the name Hagbard Selene. His real name was Karl Koch, but he had become convinced that a secret group called the Illuminati were controlling the world through computer systems. Subverting the systems was his act of resistance. Selling what he and his hacker friends could steal from the systems was also a way of funding his cocaine habit. Another hacker, known as Pengo, because he was addicted to a computer game in which a penguin of that name rushed round blocks of ice, was another key player in the motley crew that gathered. Pengo had started by hacking into the computer lab at CERN, where Tim Berners-Lee was starting to think about organizing information. But, like his kindred spirits in the gang, the Americans were the most tempting target. In early 1986, the men had decided to offer their skills to the Soviets. Both sides seemed as bad as each other, so why not make some money off one of them? They tried to justify it by saying that they would be helping the less technologically advanced side catch up with the other, evening things out, so they called it Project Equalizer. In September, Peter Karl, the sometime croupier, had driven over to Berlin and then taken the subway to the east of the city, where he walked into the Soviet trade mission. Like Cold War defectors, he had simply walked up to the glass partition and asked to speak to the KGB. When Sergei Markov appeared, Karl proposed a business deal. Sergei did not understand much about hacking, but seemed interested to learn more. Karl said he and his friends could offer a package of secret information. His price, which you can almost hear him saying in an Austin Powers voice, was 1 million German marks. Sergei told him to bring some material. After that, they could talk about a price. At the next meeting, over coffee in an apartment on Leipziger Straße, the men handed over some discs of information they thought would be interesting. But then Sergei pulled out his wish list. He wanted high-level engineering and operating systems software of the type the West had banned from being exported to the Eastern Bloc. He also wanted computer-aided design software for making chips. It was a shopping list for technology transfer. Sergei told them after receiving the first package that it was not worth $1 million, and the hackers did indeed sometimes pass off freely available software and pretended it was classified. But he explained there were things the Soviets wanted, the Line X requirements list. He wanted material on nuclear weapons and the Star Wars SDI initiative. Sergei was very clear about what he wanted. Information from U.S. military computers, plus code compilers and source code. The hackers noticed that Sergei had a very precise catalogue of what he wanted in terms of databases and software. Intriguingly, some of the items had been crossed out, even though the men knew they had not provided these items. "You have competition," the KGB man remarked. "We know the details of the gang that Cliff stole," tracked. But this suggests there may have been others. The phone call trace led German authorities to track down the gang Stoll had stumbled across. Hess was arrested in 1989 when he returned to his apartment after an early morning swim. The men at his door told him he was under suspicion of espionage. Pengo wrote a strange post on an international online computer forum saying he had been motivated by the hacker ethic and not by geopolitics. The trial proved difficult. Explaining cyber attacks to a judge and getting the right evidence in court was not easy. Stoll went over to give evidence. Hess ended up in jail. Hagbard Selin's charred body was found out in the forest. Suicide, probably. Although it was hard to be absolutely sure. How much damage was done by the group? It is hard to be certain what the Soviets did with the fresh information they received. Robert Morris wrote a memo for the NSA on the subject that suggested the Russians had got ripped off in terms of what they had got for the money. But by the time the trial took place, the world had changed. A new form of espionage had arrived just at the moment when the old game of spies was ending. Soon afterwards, the Soviet Union, unable to compete economically and technologically with the West, its legitimacy hollowed out, died its own death. The Cold War was over. But spying was not going to disappear, nor was the new world of computer-based espionage that had just emerged. In the Hanover case, hackers were becoming spies. Eventually, spies would become hackers.